Hello and welcome to Outward for the month of November. I'm Brian Lauder, editor of Outward, and I have a semi-correction from last month's episode. My mom confirms that while I did not play with dolls per se, she said that, quote, you liked a talking robot that you that asked you science questions, end quote. I checked this. This is true. Shout out to all my fellow 2XL fans out there. The smartest talking toy robot in the world.
Does that count as a doll?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it was like the size of a doll, but you put cassette tapes in it and then it would like ask you. It was like it had like ABCD buttons and it would be like a trivia thing. It was great. I did love it very much.
You just loved
sort of talked
learning.
To it a lot.
You loved learning so much.
That's me.
I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of The Waves, Slate's podcast about women and gender. And it's my birthday month this month, which means my wife was not allowed to complain when I forced us to watch yet another Kristen Stewart movie last weekend. It's my choice all month long. And we're joined this month by a special guest who you've heard from before.
I'm Ramon Alam. I am one of Slate's care and feeding advice columnists, and I am in recovery from the shock of the end of daylight savings time.
Oof.
Samesies.
So tough.
Man, it's really been brutal, and it's also been quite cold in New York the past couple of days, and I just feel underprepared.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I'm not ready either.
Yeah, it's been cold here in D.C. too. I've been wearing my fuzziest garments indoors and out. So this month, because we are gearing up for the end of the year and Thanksgiving and the holidays, and there's a lot of opportunities for multi-generational gatherings in our near future, we wanted to talk about kids. How do kids learn about gender and sexuality? How we teach them about gender and sexuality? And also how they've been occasionally weaponized to support various political agendas. You know, when we talk about raising kids or being good neighbors and friends and role models to kids, we're talking about a lot more than just kids. We're talking about the values we promote, the world we want to build, the kinds of futures people imagine for themselves. So today, I'm very excited for the topics we have on deck. We're going to kick things off with a special edition of Straight Studies, where we will bring in a representative from the straight community to chat with us about how parents and other adults in kids' lives shape their views on gender and sexuality, or don't. Then we're going to talk to Laura Edwards-Leeper, a professor at Pacific University who specializes in child psychology and gender identity. She's going to talk to us about caring for trans children and what a recent highly politicized custody battle over a trans kid says about the discourse in politics today. And we're going to recommend some items from the queer canon that we would recommend for the kids and possibly adults in your life.
But first, we're going to kick things off with our usual round of pride and provocations. Christina, what did you bring this month?
I have a pride. I am proud this month of Robin Crawford, who just published her new book, A Song for You, My Life with Whitney Houston.
Yes.
I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read some bits and pieces of it. Robin, of course, was, you know, Whitney Houston's best friend for most of her life and all of her career. They met when they were summer camp counselors in New Jersey as teenagers. And from several people's accounts, it sounds like, you know, Crawford was one of the few truly supportive and caring presences in Whitney Houston's life, which was, of course, marked by abuse and exploitation at various points. And, you know, Crawford writes very beautifully about the early moments in their relationship and the joy that they brought each other, their deep connection. She writes that, you know, they never really talked about labels like lesbian or gay, but they were physically and emotionally intimate from very early on in their relationship, although the physical part, she writes, stopped once Houston got a big record deal with Arista because, you know, she thought it would harm her career. But, you know, it really, even more so than the specifics of this book and what I read so far, is it gives me pride to see that Robin Crawford is finally able to talk about the truth of their relationship and sort of take the narrative back from everyone else who's been talking about it. I mean, it was the subject of much gossip and mm-hmm. sort of mean-spirited rumor at the time when Whitney Houston was alive. So I see this as her sort of taking that narrative back from people who hated them for their relationship or who used rumors to portray it as something scandalous, which, you know, it probably would have been at the time had they been open about their relationship. And I think she's doing right by Whitney Houston. I know Brandon Tensley, rest in peace, has talked about this on the show. You know, once someone leaves this podcast, they're dead to me. No, you know, Brandon has talked a lot about and mm-hmm. written about how very smart and attuned Whitney Houston was to the ways that she needed to portray herself, sometimes painfully or disingenuously in a way, to succeed within the sort of raced and gendered confines of popular music in America. And so I think this is a worthy addition to you know, that public narrative of Whitney Houston's life.
That's nice to hear, because I think it could so easily seem exploitative.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, but you've actually read it and looked at it and are saying that there's something deeper here. And so that's reassuring, because when I saw the news of the book, that was my first instinct. And then my second was to just feel so sad about that she died so young, and she just had this talent that was really baffling and astonishing. It's so sad.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that it's treated well as well. Ramon, are you proud or provoked?
You know, I actually am really torn about whether I am proud or provoked. I'm going to talk about a viral video, which is so unlike me. A couple of days ago, a young teenager in Indiana went viral, I'm making air quotes, for a video in which he is an out gay kid, and he was being taunted by a bully with, you know, the sort of typical epithet, and he fought back. He punched this kid and really stood up for himself. And it is very hard to watch, because I think most gay people remember hearing that as children themselves and sort of wished in that moment that they would have fought back. But of course, you don't want violence to be a part of the toolkit that kids are using to get through just being at school. So I guess I'm neither proud nor provoked, but I'm sort of happy that it exists so that people can have this irrefutable evidence of what it feels like, that that the words are a kind of violence too, and it's a kind of violence that kids who are different have to navigate daily. And, you know, every kid has a breaking point. And when you're 15 and you're full of testosterone and just sort of like your mind's not fully grown up, you can't really be blamed for physically lashing out. And I felt so sad for that kid watching it. And I felt so sad watching people kind of celebrate it also.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of, like, I don't know if this is the right term, but like, back projection. You're right. Yes. It's like I wish, right, that we wish we'd done that, but that's not really what we want. I mean, I think it is, like you said, it is good that this, you know, perhaps some people think that this kind of thing doesn't happen anymore.
Or that it doesn't hurt.
Or that it doesn't hurt. Yeah. And what are the consequences? And so, yeah, that part of it is useful, I guess, but it is sort of sad also at the same time. So I have a pride. It's sort of a small thing, but a thing that I really love. And it is pride at queer waiters in restaurants who make a point of connecting with you, with the customer, over queerness. I was reminded of how much I like this recently by going to a new restaurant in my neighborhood with one of my partners. And the waiter came up, sort of clocked us, I think, immediately as being together, treated us that way, which was like a nice thing at first, but then proceeded, before he even took our orders, to ask us our signs. so that was a clear, girl, we're like here together. And so we discussed that, and that like had some bearing on the menu that we chose, which was nice. And then he made a point, like, sort of later on and during the meal, of like mentioning his boyfriend and, you know, just like making us feel very much like we were in the hands of another queer person. And that was very warm and lovely. And of course, it formed a nice association with this new restaurant. So we'll be back, not just because the food was very good, Ronald's in Harlem, if anybody wants to go, but because of the just coolness of this waiter, sort of acknowledging our shared queerness together.
That's so lovely.
That's so cute. That's such a like Sesame Street story, mm-hmm. you know, like.
He even wrote a little cute little note on our, like, it was pizza. We had, like, a box to take home, and he wrote just, like, a little, like, thanks for coming in, yeah. like, blah, blah, blah. So, aww. Yeah.
This good reminds waiter. Me of one of my favorite things to do, which is pretend that they've gotten it all wrong, even when you're so obviously queer. Like, I recall a time that my friends and I went out. There were, like, maybe seven of us. All of whom were queer, about half of whom were, like, gender nonconforming. Like, it was very obvious what the sexuality situation was at our table. Yeah. And at the end, like, we all happened to have, like, Bank of America debit cards or something. Sorry, I know that that's, like, an evil corporation, and as queers, we should do better. Anyway, the waiter who was queer was sort of like, oh, LOL, is this, like, the official lesbian debit card? And we were like, I was like, we're not gay. Like, what the hell are you talking about?
And
the
so look rude.
Of panic on his face was incredible. And then I was like, haha, just kidding. And he was like, oh, my God, thank God. Oh,
that's so
rude. It was
rude.
A really fun and mean joke to play. Try it out sometime.
I was in Fort Worth just this past week. I'm visiting my husband, who's been working there for the past couple of weeks, and we were with the kids, and we went out for tacos one morning. This is the inverse of Brian's story.
Oh no!
We went out for tacos one morning, and we had a lovely waiter, and then at the end, he said he looked at us and said, "Do you want separate checks?" And I was like, "What is the calculus here? We're here at 9 o'clock in the morning with our children."
Oh my God!
And I guess he was just like, "Well, obviously, you're just like two guys who happen to know each other having breakfast together with
the wives are at
kids.
Home."
Your wives are getting the pedicures, and you guys are
gymnastics of that.
It was really, and this is not the first time this has happened. It happens at restaurants, typically not in New York City, and but I actually think it's kind of sweet and funny.
Yeah, yeah, that's wild. the backflips he had to do that. Homophobia is a bitch. Okay.
TM.
TM, yeah.
The new Starz series, Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now. Only on Starz and the Starz app.
Well, speaking of straight people, in honor of all the straight waiters out there who don't understand what's happening at the tables they serve, we'd like to welcome our straight correspondent, Allison Benedict. Welcome, Allison.
Hello. I'm happy to be here.
So as I said at the beginning of the episode, we wanted to talk about kids in part because we have so many family gatherings coming up in the future. But for me, I was thinking about this month because, you know, in our last episode, we talked about Mattel's new gender neutral doll. And my niece came to visit me. She's three recently. And I had her play with the doll. And, you know, I was sort of like very performatively like, this doll can be any gender. And she's like, you know, clearly doesn't understand what gender is, but was very excited about the variety of clothing that she could possibly put on the doll. She did understand, though, when I was like, you know, this doll could be a boy or a girl, or like it's a he or it's a she. And then she was like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then kind of like used pronouns that differed throughout the course of her play. I think she finally settled on a he, him pronoun, but, you know, dressed the doll in all manner of feminine clothing. But it got me thinking about, you know, how kids conceive of gender and sexuality and what sorts of influence people, parents, aunts and uncles, friends and neighbors can actually have on a kid and how much they sort of figure out on their own or glean from pop culture. So I'm really excited to have multiple parents in this discussion. And I'll put it to you guys first. Do you feel any sort of duty or compulsion to instill any sort of ideas about gender and sexuality in your kids?
I think it's inevitable that a parent will kind of instill their politics in their kid. And as gender and sexual identity have become sort of like staple parts of the political discourse. They've become things that are just part of what you talk about. So when my kids were old enough when Hillary Clinton was running for president that we could have that conversation about what it is or what it meant to us as adults to see a woman running for president and what that meant to the culture. And so there's just a familiarity there that's an extension of being a sort of like liberal New York parent. And so gender falls within that more comfortably now, I think, than it did when I was a child myself. But the flip side of that is that I am a gay dad. And part of like the worst kind of thinking that sort of like anti-gay parenting is the idea that you are somehow indoctrinating your kid with, you know, who knows what, like, as though gayness were a communicable disease or something. And so then there is a sensitivity there in us as parents to, you know, there's just a sensitivity there. But also, now that I have children, I realize that you can't actually even give them your political values.
Do you mean a sensitivity, though, like you feel a certain pressure to
to not be perceived as like programming our kids with some kind of like to be gay or just like teaching them that like boys can wear skirts or something,
right?
Even though, of course, boys can wear skirts. So like it's hard to get a handle on what's, you know, in so many ways we are such square parents, right? Like we drive a minivan and we go to like soccer or whatever. This is all like an internal struggle of, are we trying not to make them into sissies because we are afraid of being accused of indoctrinating them somehow? And at the same time, I think that the very notion of being a sissy is like ridiculous and old fashioned. And of course, little boys can wear skirts and push strollers and all of that stuff that like modern parents encourage in their children.
Well, so I mean, what you said at first, we have a similar dynamic in that just in our household, we talk about politics a lot. So, you know, we talk about racism, we talk about income inequality. I think the way you phrased it was like, if you feel a certain duty, and duty implies some kind of like greater external responsibility. And I think I do feel that when it comes to sexism, like, you know, whatever, there are all those books. There's so many books like The Rad American Women and 25 Great Female Scientists. Like, I'm surprised that they even know that men can be scientists. when it comes to sexuality and like gender fluidity, that stuff, I would say, like, I feel like we are less out in front of, and we kind of take those conversations as they come, and it's much more about like, I feel a duty to make sure my children are comfortable being who they are and happy and feel supported. But I don't think we've introduced that many conversations about like what it means to be transgender, transgender rights, or gender fluidity. We tend to take those conversations, I guess, more as they come, like if the kids come to us and ask about things. I feel like in our like sort of day to day, there's a lot of like just it feels very basic, but a lot of like, oh, our middle son, like he loves glittery jewelry. And so we're like supportive of his love of glittery jewelry, or like we've encouraged him to like take a dance class because he loves to dance and he feels that dance is like a girly thing and he doesn't want to do it. All these like extremely like feels like, you know, it doesn't feel different than a conversation parents might have had with their kids 5 years ago.
Are they having those conversations in school, though, about identity and about... Because, I've heard my kids use the word transgender based on something that they're hearing in school.
Yeah.
So is that happening in your school system?
Yeah, I mean, I think the baseline knowledge is different now.
Yeah,
and the baseline, like, I don't know what the word is, like, tolerance, I guess. Like, it's not, you know, just, I don't know what it was like for you guys when you were growing up, but for them, like, whatever, just having friends who have two dads or two moms, that's just not a thing.
Yeah.
It's, like, not a thing at all. And so we don't really even talk about it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's good or bad, because maybe it is. Maybe they are more curious in their mind, and I just sort of take it for granted that they take it for granted.
That it's incredible how much has changed in some ways. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, it definitely was a thing to learn that some adult was gay. And certainly there were very few out gay kids. And I grew up in New Hampshire, which is, you know, more or less socially liberal and was at the time when I was growing up. But, you know, when we found out that, for instance, my student council advisor in high school was gay, it wasn't like a shock, and nobody that I witnessed was like homophobic toward her, but it still was a big deal. And like, I think we thought it was very like cool and different. But it's also incredible how much hasn't changed. Like, just to hear that your kid thinks, you know, dance class is girly and he might have a little like reluctance to participate in something like that. Like, I think there are so many norms that are incredibly persistent. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I think about is, how do we teach kids and raise kids? And so whenever I think about, you know, do I want kids, or what does it mean to be an influence on, or even just in relationship with the kids in my life, my friend's kids or my sister's kids, I'm like, how do I indoctrinate them? Like, kind of exactly what you were saying, Ruman, that hope gay people aren't doing. I am a little bit like, how do I indoctrinate them? Because even though, you know, there might not be a way to turn your kid gay or turn your kid straight, for that matter, I do think that there, when kids are trying to figure out who they are, there are so many barriers to a kid being able to explore being gay or being trans, and even to realize, even if from a young age they feel that that might be true for them, even to realize that, like, A, I can be that, and no matter who I am, what I look like that label or that lifestyle or identity could fit me. And then also that, you know, that you could have a great future in any one of those identity groups. Like, I just remember, especially if you're not gay, not straight, but maybe like bi or pan or something, and it doesn't necessarily feel wrong to you to be in a, you know, relationship with somebody of a different gender, like, it might take you a really long time to even recognize that it's possible for you to find fulfillment in relationship with somebody of your same gender.
It could just be the case that these things naturally require time and maturity as an individual. And I think that the way that you actually indoctrinate is by adult presence. Like, you remember this lesbian figure from your own childhood. Mm-hmm. Like, it does make an impact. And, like, it's not about indoctrination. It's just about providing for kids a very visible example of, like, the multiple ways that they could be an adult.
I think that makes a huge difference. There's some level of like kind of engineering and parenting that I think is really hard to achieve. Like, you hear people talk about, like, I didn't buy my boys trucks. They just were drawn to trucks. And then, there are some parents who would certainly like, they wouldn't buy trucks, right? They would only buy like gender neutral toys or gender neutral clothes, or it's like a lifestyle to do that. Yeah. It's intense. Yeah. And I frankly, like, I just don't parent like that in other parts of the parenting life either. And it feels, I mean, maybe this is just a cop-out, but it feels extremely overwhelming and like it has to be like your main priority to work that way. Whereas having like all different kinds of people in your life feels full and wonderful. And how you would want your life to be.
I think that's so I'm hanging back in this conversation a little bit because I can't really remember the last time I spoke to a child. so I don't want to like speak out of school about like that.
You're
part
welcome
of it.
To babysit.
Sure. Maybe I should. Yeah. Maybe that's a good idea.
The kids need a gay presence in their life.
Yeah. And I do look forward. Yeah. I do definitely look forward to, you know, perhaps one day maybe being like a gay uncle. That would be very fun. I would be into it. But what I wanted to say was like to this idea of having like many different kinds of adults in the child's life as a way of sort of modeling possibility. That seems to me to be something that is so perhaps regionally specific. I'm thinking about like in my own childhood, I didn't have any of that in terms of other gay people, at least that were out about it. There now, in retrospect, I am aware of some people who were gay, but in South Carolina, in you know the 90s, it wasn't discussed, and so I don't think I really knew the word until like way late, and definitely didn't figure out that it had anything to do with like an identity or me until I got to college, until I came to New York. And so, you know, the availability of all of those role models in a child's life, I think it just is so dependent on where you live and what the kind of culture of that place is. And of course, you know, do your parents have a lot of friends and like all of that, but, that seems like something that if you live in a place that's not New York or not, you know, a city, maybe you do have to engineer it into their lives a little bit if you want that influence there.
Well, Mattel has a new gender neutral doll.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Thinking about this also made me wonder about the ways we think about heterosexuality and homosexuality as sexualities versus identities. Like when I think about the ways even just very young children get a sense of what's normal and, you know, what does a normal family look like? It's not just, you know, I think a lot of people would say like, oh, well, what, don't impute sexuality onto like characters, for instance, that you're exposing young children to. But I mean, every story that children absorb from a very young age, or most stories, have like parents, for instance, mm-hmm. or a family structure. And almost all the time, I mean, besides like books specifically written to counteract the like heterocentric like worldview of children's books, like every other cultural product children absorb from my perspective has straight parents, and like those are people in a romantic and sexual relationship, even though sexuality doesn't play into it at all, like their identity as straight people does. And I wonder, you know, as kids are learning about like what do families look like, what sorts of relationships do adults have, like when they're getting that sort of message from the stuff that they're watching, like it's not just about sexuality. I mean, and you know, kids of course like do have sexualities and understand sexuality. I think kids from a very young age are like making their dolls have sex and things like that. It's now a rule on Outward that every episode we have to talk about dolls having sex. I'm pretty sure we talked about this last time too.
There should be like a little sound effect.
Yeah. But yeah, it just says to me like teaching kids about you know, queerness, for instance, isn't the same as teaching them about sex. And I think that's something that the conservatives who will pass these like no promo homo laws where like teachers in schools can't even talk about, you know, queerness at all. Like, I think it's telling that their perspective is very sex focused. Like, oh, well, if you wouldn't teach a kid about sex acts, why would you bring being gay into it? But it's about a way of being and not necessarily just about sex.
But it's the sex that panics people, of course. And as you say, like, you know, heterosexual as an identity is also related to sex. And the truth is that kids figure sex out much earlier, I think, than people are comfortable admitting. And mm-hmm. they draw conclusions, and a lot of them are really like sort of sweet and funny and confused, but they figure this out, and it's like part of the animal nature. And it's very distressing to people to confront that.
Do parents now, or do y'all like put sexual and gender identity into sort of like the talk or the series of talks around puberty and adolescence? And in that case, it seems like you would just be kind of introducing the idea that there are people who are heterosexuals and people who are, it's like very scientific, right? But that's separate from the sort of much richer notion of a gay and lesbian and, you know, LGBT community and like a political history and like all of that stuff that's like, you could, in theory, talk about before you had that sex
talk. Yeah,
that
stuff is easier.
Yeah. Like, it's interesting to think about the
25 gay scientists.
Yeah. But, like, it's a funny idea to think about, like, what does gay then mean to that child if it's not about sex? Like, because you, as a gay person, you experience the sex part, the attraction part first.
Well, maybe
right?
It's about love.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you're talking to kids about relationships in general.
Brian's like, oh, yeah, love.
You forgot about that part.
That's
Brian
it.
Was like this.
Yeah. No, this is why I'm not speaking.
No. I mean, also, even when your kids are very little, I mean, I know some people talk to their kids about sex, like, extremely early, so then they never have to get over that weird, awkward hump when they're older. We unfortunately didn't do it that way, and I really regret it. I remember an old colleague of ours, Hannah Rosen, said that she just, like, one day in the swimming pool when her kid was, like, 2 and a half, she was like, this is sex. Yeah. I was like, damn, I wish we had done that, and we hadn't. But anyway,
the
early conversations about sex, whether heterosexual or homosexual, is two people love each other, they...
Yeah,
totally.
And okay. That definitely, like, that is like a way of, that is simplifying what Christina's talking about, but it's like a, accessible to a child to talk about mm-hmm. sex in those terms. And I also think that the notion of one talk is kind of outdated at this point, right?
Sure.
And it's sort of like you're laying the groundwork because the kids are coming home hearing these conversations in school or among friends about, you know, oh, God, I don't even have, like, a pop cultural referent, but they'll hear something sort of vaguely pop cultural and say, like, this person said that they're gay or whatever, you know, and that gives you an opportunity to have that conversation even before they have, like, because the language around attraction and your own sexual maturity is, like, not... It's not a verbal language. It's like this sort of interior language. And so you're just providing them with like an alphabet, and sooner or later they're going to figure out how to spell, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's such a good analogy.
Oh, thanks.
Talking about this stuff also strikes me similarly to like when I think about how white people should talk to their kids about race. Mm-hmm. Like there's certainly like a lot of people I think who think it's better to like not talk about it and like we don't see, you know, we don't see race, but obviously like all the research says that's not a good idea at all. And so I think the same about this probably for straight parents is like it's just better to have it be part of the conversation early, and then it feels it's much less like we're not pretending we live in a world that we don't live in.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was thinking about that's similar to that, Allison, is when I have been looking at some like kids' books about LGBT history or something, like it's hard to talk about that or like what you were talking about, Brian, you know, about LGBT culture and a political, you know, history without it focusing on a lot of bad stuff, discrimination. Yes. And, you know, I was reading a book that was like meant for kids the other day, like, oh, maybe this would be good for my niece or something. And it was like The Assassination of Harvey Milk. And I was like... Okay, like now we have to talk about like sometimes people kill each other. Like
I mean, this is everything. Yeah. This is parenting. Yeah. I feel like it wasn't like this for our parents because they just
didn't talk about it.
No,
and I think it's sort of that indicates where we are politically. You know, like it's like you said about race. It's the same. It's really the same conversation, or it's an analogous conversation because because both of my children are black, so trying to teach them about blackness specifically does involve teaching them all the stuff that is a tremendous bummer.
Yeah.
You know? And it's important to talk about.
And you can't, there's no like dolling it up. You know, it's just like, some people think black people are lesser, and that guided like all of American history until like right now. And saying, I mean, kids can kind of deal with a lot more than I think people think they can, and they can try and make sense of that, even though it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I think sex and sexuality works kind of the same way. And they can, you know, when I explain to them the injustice of, like, you know, from those 50 books of great women scientists, like, the injustice of Marie Curie not, like, being acknowledged as a great scientist or whatever, like they can make sense of that. And it's important that they do.
I think that's all the time we have for this incredibly vital and wonderful discussion. Thank you so much for joining us, Allison. It was great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for speaking for the entire straight community.
I did everyone proud.
Your perspective is valid and appreciated.
In late October, news broke of a heartbreaking custody battle between two divorced parents in Coppell, Texas, centered around the gender identity of their 7-year-old daughter, Luna Younger. Luna has identified as a girl since she was about 3 and has been professionally diagnosed with gender dysphoria. Her mother has supported Luna's desire to socially transition by dressing in feminine clothing, growing her hair long, and changing her name. Meanwhile, her father has made waves in conservative media by rejecting Luna's trans identity and claiming that she wants to live as a boy when in his care, though a slew of other family members, doctors, school staff, and therapists have denied this. As the case stands now, the parents have joint custody, and while that's on appeal, Luna must move between one household that supports who she is and another that actively undermines it. If that weren't hellish enough, her case has also become the focal point of a conservative panic around trans youth and their health care, with Ted Cruz calling Luna, quote, a pawn in a left-wing political agenda, end quote, and Texas Governor Greg Abbott reportedly directing state agencies to investigate the family. Much of the drama here centers on the notion that Luna's mother and other trans-affirming parents like her are out to, quote-unquote, chemically castrate their young children and force them to undergo other scary-sounding medical procedures that the child might later regret, We want to say it up front here on the podcast that this is not true. This is not what happens. But to help us unpack why and how it is untrue, we're joined today by Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper, a clinical psychologist at Pacific University who specializes in child psychology, gender nonconformity, and transgender care. Thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're actually not going to talk in too much detail about the case today, but I want to point our listeners to a really great piece over in Vox by Caitlin Burns called What the Battle Over a Seven-Year-Old Trans Girl Could Mean for Families Nationwide. If you want to know more about this case in particular, there'll be a link on the show page, but that piece really gets into the details. What we want to use it for today is as a jumping off point for a broader discussion about trans youth healthcare. So when a child like Luna comes to a parent with a sense that they would like to socially transition or express their gender differently, what is the current sort of medical professional advice on to do for a parent in that case?
Well, typically the best thing to do is to first consult with a professional who... Uh-huh. You know, is knowledgeable in this area and trained to work with young children and fully understands the complexities of child development and, you know, is able to take some time with the family to really understand, you know, what's going on and what's in the child's best interest. And then through that assessment, if it seems clear that the child, you know, is really strongly pushing for presenting in a different gender from what they were assigned, then many times that is the recommended course of action, particularly if it's going to alleviate a lot of psychological and emotional distress, improve behavioral issues that might be present because of the gender dysphoria. And so that, you know, that often is the case in some cases, in some situations.
Right. And so it starts with yeah, like this consultation with sort of like a therapist or psychologist or someone like that who can add more guidance. But we're not talking, and I said this already, but we're not talking about medical interventions at this stage of the game, right, when you're talking about a young child.
Absolutely not. We would never intervene medically with a child that hasn't even reached puberty yet.
One thing that's stuck out to me as I've, you know, read about the case in Texas and several other articles that I've read about trans kids and, you know, the reaction to that, especially in right-wing media, is it seems like there's a real fixation on the body of the child in question. You know, whenever there's a discussion about trans and gender-affirming care for kids, we hear it talked about in terms of a quote-unquote sex change. Or, you know, worried about making irreversible changes to a child's body. Where do you think that fixation and that fear comes from?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think that our culture is just very focused on sexuality and, you know, and a fear of, you know, children, I guess, in particular, being sexual beings. So maybe that's part of it. You know, I think that, you know, there are certainly fears that people have around homosexuality that may play into that. But, you know, it's really misguided for people to focus on that, you know, with anyone, I mean, anybody, any gender dysphoric person, transgender people, adults, adolescents, and, you know, especially children, because we're not, you know, we're not even thinking about that with younger children. Basically, we're just considering allowing and supporting the child in presenting themselves in their identity and being true to themselves. And so sometimes that can mean changing their name and pronouns. It can mean changing their gender expression, which would be things like clothing or hairstyle, and also just allowing them to engage in the kinds of activities that they're drawn toward and not kind of forcing them into what's considered stereotypically masculine or feminine types of play and activities.
Yeah. And how does that change as a child approaches puberty?
A lot of it continues to stay the same. The only thing that we start to consider in some cases as a child starts to progress towards puberty is, you know, the consideration of puberty suppressing medication. The goal of that is just to give the child more time to continue sorting out their identity as they're, you know, a little more mature, as they're maturing into adolescence and they're you know, cognitively, emotionally, psychologically able to understand themselves and the world in a bit more of a sophisticated manner. It gives them time to really think about how they want to proceed with their identity, how they, you know, and to really reflect on how they feel about their identity and what kinds, if any, you know, other medical interventions they might want to do when they get older.
It's interesting reading up on this and talking to you about it. Like, there's a real sense that the approach here should be that the child needs to lead. And I think that that is probably, like, challenging for a lot of parents who might approach parenting generally as a thing that where their role is to sort of lead the child and guide the child. And you're talking about having, you know, quite young children, in fact, sort of taking the lead in their sort of self-determination. How do you think about, you know, shifting parents' view of that in these cases? Because it seems like that could be a real paradigm shift for a lot of parents.
Well, I guess I don't see it quite so black and white. Uh-huh. I mean, I do think that there is certainly an element of taking the child's lead, but it really has to be done in a very thoughtful and balanced manner, because children are children. And so, you know, the way that they understand the world and just think about everything, including gender, is very concrete and black and white, just because of the state of their brain development at young ages. And so, so yes, I mean, absolutely, we need to follow the child's lead, but some children, gender does fluctuate. And for example, I worked with a child who told me that they felt like a boy when it rained. I live in Portland, Oregon, so it rains a lot here. So I don't know what that says about their gender identity, but, you know, so some kids really are, you know, one day they may feel one way, one day they may feel another way. And it's critical that we're not assuming that the way a child feels at one point in time is necessarily going to predict how they feel tomorrow or next year or 5 years from now or when they're 25 years old or beyond. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the challenge, and that's why having, you know, professional guidance is really, really helpful for a lot of these parents and families, because there is a lot in the news right now about how to best support these kids. And it's very, you know, it's kind of like, either you support them or you don't. And, you know, I kind of see it as, you know, there being a lot more nuance to it that people aren't always recognizing. But I do think that, you know, that I sometimes work with parents who have a fear that if they, you know, allow their child to play with the toys that they want to play with, even if they don't align from a kind of stereotypical gendered manner with the assigned gender of the child, that that's somehow going to make the child transgender or, you know, cause more confusion. And I can say very confidently that that is not going to happen. I've never seen that happen. But in fact, it actually has a very positive effect when children are allowed to, you know, just engage in the things that bring them joy and happiness. And that kind of gets more into the, just in my mind, the problem with the gender binary that we have in our culture, that, you know, we kind of enforce upon children, that is really damaging to them as they grow up, whether they're transgender or cisgender or somewhere in between, non-binary or some other gender.
So in the Vox article that I mentioned at the top of the segment, they talk about how a number of legislators, conservatives around the country, are threatening bills. None of these, as far as I know, have been really advanced yet, but are threatening bills that could outlaw things like puberty blockers or make it even child abuse, quote unquote, to allow a kid to transition. If that sort of thing happened, what would be the impact on the kids you work with and just the work you do generally?
That would be extremely detrimental for these kids. I mean, I honestly can't imagine how horrible that would be if that were to end up happening. You know, it's been incredible to see with not just, you know, my own clinical experience, but some research now that supports that these young children who are supported in their identities do very well psychologically. And, you know, And prior to being supported, they do not do well. And I've worked with children whose parents and sometimes the therapist involved took a more kind of behavioral approach to try to just help the child feel comfortable in their assigned gender and the body that they were given. And it didn't work. And, you know, the child's emotional and behavioral problems were just horrible. And so the parents then eventually decided they couldn't do that anymore because that felt like child abuse. And so, you know, they sought a different kind of help and began supporting their child. And many of them talk about it being like flipping a switch that, you know, suddenly their child's mental health problems improved and they were confident and had friends and, you know, no more behavioral problems, no more emotional problems. So, yeah, it would be extremely detrimental for these kids if, you know, if legislature was to go forward in that way. And same with the medical stuff. You know, I think for the adolescents that, you know, we've come so far with being able to support children in a way that's for those who, again, you know, who really need it and will benefit from it. It's been such an amazing intervention, both the blockers and then being able to use hormone treatment and sometimes surgeries for older adolescents and improving their quality of life and improving their mental health symptoms and all of that, that to take that away, particularly, you know, with the medical stuff with adolescents, with all the risk they have of severe mental health issues, including suicide, self-harm, all of that, that could be extremely detrimental.
Yeah. On that note, as we wrap up this segment, I wonder if you could just distill one or a couple key takeaways for our listeners, you know, as they go out into the holiday season prepared to possibly debunk myths or better the understanding of the people around them about, you know, care for trans kids.
I mean, I think the most important thing is just, you know, to encourage people to not get so stuck on the binary when it comes to gender, and to, you know, try to move away from thinking that certain toys are for boys and certain toys are for girls and certain colors are for boys and certain colors are for girls, and that clothing, you know, all of it, and that, you know, just allowing kids to be kids and be happy, and, you know, in situations where they feel strongly about their gender identity and, you know, they're clear about that, you know, that they really do benefit from being supported in that. And in other cases, if they just don't have the interests that align with their assigned gender, they should be, you know, the child should be supported in that, you know, and to not make children feel ashamed or embarrassed or that it's not okay to play with the toys they want to play with and do the things they want to do. I mean, they're going to be healthier people, whether they're ultimately transgender or cisgender or something else, if they're allowed to follow their heart and be who they are.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Edwards-Leeper, thank you so much for the work you do, but then second for being on the show with us. I think it's been really, really helpful.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
I think that's about it for this month. But before we go, I think we have time to talk about our updates to the gay agenda.
Yes.
And if I can go first, because I'm worried about Christina beating me to it.
Oh.
But tomorrow I am going to go see Charlie's Angels, starring the sexiest man, woman, or other I can think of, Kristen Stewart, and I'm very excited about it. It looks totally ridiculous, but totally fun.
She's so good. She's such a bad actress, but I'll watch her do anything.
She's, you know, if you look like that, I don't think you have to be a good actor.
No, you don't. So the movie that I was talking about that I recently watched was Personal Shopper.
Yep. Yeah.
Very first scene, like no dialogue has been spoken yet. She walks out in a leather jacket, and I'm just like, And my wife goes, you're allowed to make three more of those noises for the rest of this film. Use them wisely. But yeah, I mean, we value her because of the way she looks staring into middle distance with no expression on her face. Yes. We don't value her for her acting. I'm going to recommend One Day at a Time. It's a sitcom that aired for a couple seasons on Netflix and is now going to be resurrected at Pop. It's about a Cuban-American family in L.A. The daughter in the family, Elena, is, I believe, in high school. She's gay. She dates a non-binary person named Sid. And it's just such a positive view of how families can, like, learn about and deal with and support a queer kid. The show is just so, so corny. And I think that's a good thing, actually, in this case. It takes on, like, pretty difficult issues, but always wraps them into a bow at the end of the episode. There's some good-natured jokes about how this Elena is, like, a super activist. The grandma, like, doesn't understand the word Latinx. And, like, right. but the jokes are never punching down. And I think it's just a very lovely vision of, like, a queer youth that doesn't diminish them. The other one I'm going to recommend is Lumberjanes, which is a series of comics and graphic novels about girls at a kind of scouting camp. And so there's, like, a core group of girls, and there's actually one non-binary character in the group, too. One of the girls is trans. Two of the girls have a romance together. And it's just really fun and adventurous and full of, like, supernatural characters. The two things that I picked are both visual because I think although I do love a lot of queer books, I think it can be really powerful to actually see, like, a wide variety of what queer people can look like. And both of these shows do a really good job of, you know, showing, having, like, queer characters being queer, but also not having that be, like, their only characteristic. Yeah. And also not reducing their storylines to ones of trauma. Like, both of the stories are have pretty optimistic visions of what queer life can look like. Highly recommend both of them.
So I was thinking about a movie I wish I had seen younger, because I think it would have done a lot of the things we were talking about earlier for me. And that is The Birdcage, actually.
I love that movie.
I think it's probably a film for slightly older kids, but not, I don't think you have to be super old. And I think it's great because it sort of is a perfect account of, like, the value of difference, and, like, what forcing people into conformity, how painful that can be and how impoverishing that can be to a life. I think it shows different sorts of families, of course. And then it has just the fun identity exploration that drag offers.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, a younger child would just have a lot of fun watching, you know, the drag queens who are a type of clown, I think you could say. I mean, they probably relate to that. But then you get all of these other sort of messages, yeah, just about, like, the value of difference and the possibilities that a life could look like, in a very lighthearted, you know, funny, and then you know, it's politically kind of biting too when you're ready for that kind of part of it, for the conservative side of things. But I just think it's beautiful, and it stands up really well. There's some certain aspects that are a little problematic now, but most of it I think works. So yeah, Birdcage is something I would love to have seen younger and would love to show to future nieces and nephews, maybe.
All of these also are very good for adults, too. I mean, I
watch it at least once a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think that is it for November. Please send us feedback and topic ideas at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook and Twitter @SlateOutward. We're also always looking for questions, for potential advice segments. So please send those our way, too. Thank you to Melissa Kaplan, who provided engineering assistance for this episode. Our producer is the wonderful Daniel Schrader. June Thomas is senior managing producer of Slate Podcast and, insider fact, one of the Gay Mafia's most prized recruiters. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. We'll be back in your feeds on December 18th. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you, guys.
See you, Christina.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.